Hello, everybody. You're listening to the Sunday Sermon Podcast for Sunday, the 30th of April, 2017. Well, you're very welcome back to the podcast. Listeners from last week will recall that I told a tale of myself and the transition years going down to Cool Park and having a lovely time and nothing of incident happened. And I wasn't looking for Yeats's gold. And apparently, on the same day, someone stole a JCB and tore up over 5 acres of land, which is illegal. So, if anyone listened to last week's podcast, inferred anything from that relating to this digging up thing and the guy they're looking for, a 6'10" elderly kind of tall, slim priest type, you know it wasn't me, so we'll just park that there. This week I'd like to talk about a young friend of mine who's got himself in a bit of bother. That young friend is Ja Rule, a musician whose acquaintance I made at the arraignment for a mutual friend, Suge Knight, a few years ago. This week, Ja Rule got himself in a spot of bother, and everyone's very upset with him. See, after Suge's unfortunate sentencing, Ja Rule and I headed outside for a bite to eat, and I recall him telling me over a burrito on the steps of the courthouse on that rainy day in 2015 that he intended on putting on a concert on an island, that he and his young friend, a computer goon or whatever you call it, had actually happened across. See, the two boys, amateur pilots, aimlessly flew their plane for ages until they ran out of petrol and they happened to land near this island. It's sort of like a spirited game of chicken with gravity. The island was the islands of the Exhumas, and at the moment Ja Rule's reputation is currently being exhumed there. See, Ja was telling me all about this. It sounded very interesting. He told me tickets were going to be a steal at only 12 grand, which when you think about it is just the cost of getting an altar cleaned, or an organ scraped, or an old priest's bi-monthly old-to-young blood transfusion, which is a wonderful service carried out by the Sisters of Charity. Ja Rule told me that all the guests were going to be staying in the lap of luxury with their every whim catered to, and it wasn't going to rain, and everyone was going to be out and about in the sun enjoying the fabulous music and having a really groovy time on the island and having beers but not getting too drunk. And everything was just going to be great. I found it hard to sort of imagine this paradise. And then Ja Rule, reading the room well, said, "Listen, Quick, imagine if Liston Varna took place on Ackle." My eyes lit up and said, "Where the whiskey flow like the crystal streams they say flow in heaven. Where the crack is only 90, there's a match on the telly, there's lovely ladies about, and you and your friends are sneaking puffs of a snaky cigarette you found in the jacks, because the pub is packed and it would take them ages to find out who was smoking the cigarette, and sure, you only YOLO once. Can an uncelestial being dare dream of such delights on earth? Well, imagine how good that would be. Then apply that criteria to millennials and all their favourite things. It was going to be absolutely fabulous. Fire Festival, Fiery Festival, it's going to be the name of it. And it was Jazz idea along with this tech entrepreneur, Billy McFarland. And it was going to have Instagram-friendly supermodels like Bella Hadid, Channel Iman, Emily Ratajkowski. They were all going to be there, all the big stars. All the biggest bands too, Blink-182, and other bands, Skepta, Major Lazer, members of Kanye West's G.O.O.D. music hip-hop troupe. I mean, all that, and Instagram's Emily Ratajkowski. How could you lose? Everyone was going to sleep in beautiful tents on big beanbags, and there'd be a big man in a dress pretending to be a huge mammy to tuck them in at night, to read them a story and warm their binky, which I understand is some sort of child's cloth, and it was going to be great. When Quigg was a boy, children weren't entrusted with such extravagances as a cloth. I remember our more well-to-do neighbours, Their mother had died of flu and their father had both his shins blown out fighting for the British overseas and had taken to morphine in a big way. He gave his kids a rag to play with and for us that was the height of spoiling them. This was back before there were lots of films and you ruined the ends of things and spoilers were just things on cars that hit your brother so you could get a payout from the man driving it, or it was a way to turn your child soft. I remember there was holy war over that rag. They thought they were so big with that rag, thought they were cock of the walk. Sure, they never talked about it. I suppose we only got wind of it because a certain little quig was hiding under their table, stealing cheese from their extravagant mouse traps. This was a family full of notions. They were too good to use a large knife like the rest of us. No, they had to use a mouse trap, but quig thanks them for the cheese. But you should have seen these sons of bitches with their rag. They thought they were amazing. They'd be all the time shoving it in our faces after we'd beaten the location of its hiding place out of them. Remember, it caused all of us to break the most sacred commandment. Thou must not covet thy neighbour's stuff and their bits and their pieces and their finery. There was fighting and kicking and very primitive psychological mind games and a very brief and thankfully unfaithful drowning. But in the end, I got that rag. But when I did, I thought, what's the point of this? So I burned it. So I certainly understand the younger generation's coveting of a cloth for comfort. And maybe I'd been too hasty in my youth to incinerate the rag instead of exploring the possible benefits that could be extracted from forming such a relationship with this textile. Would it become my best friend or my worst enemy? If I could go back in time, I wouldn't change a thing. But as Ja spoke more and more about Fiery Fest, as he called it, I realised that holding a concert on a spooky island with no water or sewerage infrastructures, you know, and this whole thing's been ran by a 40-year-old rapper and some computer goon in his early 20s, and they're marketing through Instagram nitwits. I thought, this is a really good idea. Quig wants in. He said, well, what can you bring to the table, Quig? I told him how I was the brains behind TedFest, which is not inaccurate. I remember hearing a lot of people out one night quoting Father Ted, and I said they should put all these people on an island. So in a way, I did come up with it, but I said, don't look it up because it's not online. I said I also helped out with Oxygen for a few years, but don't look that up because it's not online. And then I know certain people in the UN who can fast track cutting red ribbony stuff. And Ja was very excited by that part, so I was brought on as an equal partner. And of course, Mick Lowry, who I share an email address with, he's a TD, he's my best friend, Mick. He desperately wanted to be part of it. He loves organising sort of concerts. He thinks he's a bit of a Albert Reynolds type. Former Taoiseach who knew a thing or two about putting on show bands in a hall and charging 25 quid. I said, look, you can't. You're bad at this. Remember the second last gig you'd organised, Woodstock 2? He said, look, it had its moments. It was like Woodstock 1, except instead of Free Love and Jimi Hendrix, it was a bunch of sex offenders and Kid Rock. And sure, people didn't like it, but that wasn't the worst. And I said, well, what about the Swedish House Mafia gig in Phoenix Park you organised a few years ago? And he said, yes, look, sure, at the end of that gig, there were 3 dead and 9 injured by stabbing. And that was a tragedy because there was 1 more dead and 2 more injured by stabbing than I'd been insured for. But I think I'm ready to make a comeback. I think this is it. Well, I said, you should not touch this because this is just for Quig. So anyway, Jazz pal and Fiery Fest co-creator Billy McFarland, when he got wind that Ja Rule wanted to bring a aged 6'10" cleric into this fun in the sun for moneyed young people party, he was not happy. We were at loggerheads from day one. I said, how do you do? I'm Father Quig. And he said, I'm Billy McFarland. Seth McFarland is a relative of mine. And after I'd made some inquiries and he told me who Seth McFarland was, I said, much like a talent for the bagpipes, being related to Seth McFarland is a boast best kept to oneself. He just sort of stared at me and we began to chat anyway, tried to break the tension in the room. I said, "What are you watching on telly?" And he said, "Oh, I'm watching Empire." And I said, "Oh, I've got the finale saved on my Skybox. I'm going to watch it tonight." And then he spoiled it on me. He spoiled it with relish. He loved it. I turned to Jan. I said, "I don't like this guy. I'm out. As a partner in this venture, I'm done." And then I left the room. Jan chased me down the corridor and begged me to reconsider because there was a lot of red tape to get through. But I told him, "Billy gives me the willy. Willies, that is. He's freaking out Quig, and Quig has to listen to Quig's gut. This is the same gut that told Quig that a bomb was about to go off in the Hotel Europa. It was the same gut that told Quig to walk away from that case of M16s in Kabul right before that car bomb went off. But I told Jan, look, stay in touch, but listen, watch out for Billy. I've seen his like before. He's a silly lad, like Rufus Wainwright's brother, Doofus Wainwright, or like Jamie Kennedy, or the lad who cheated on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, or John Rambo. Silly lads and bad apples, one and all." Well, Jan, he kept in touch, but it seemed like everything with Fiery Fest was ticking along well, despite Billy's being there. I suggested they change the name from Fire, F-I-R-E, to F-Y-R-E, because we've done it with Oxygen, to give it an edge, and also to avoid copyright infringement with the Oxygen channel owned by Oprah, and also the Oxygen Chemical, which is copyright the periodic table. Well, what could go wrong, you ask? Everything seems to be going great, Quig. What could happen? Well, I'll tell you. Two words. Mick. Yes, that's right. Mick Lowry had infiltrated the team under the name of Punches Your Lights Out, and had quickly risen up through the ranks thanks to a bit of hard work and liberal amounts of quote-unquote blackmail. His mantra, "Leave it to me," reassured the organisers that he was on top of things, when in fact, I've learned over years, decades of friendship, that Mick saying "leave it to me" really means, "I've forgotten what you wanted me to do, so I'm going to go and find a place to sit down and read Lee Child's on my Kindle." Well, it wasn't too long before news of Mick Lowry's involvement began to spread, and things were backlogged, and it wasn't before long that I got a call from Mark from Bling182, said, "Is it true, Quig? Is Mick Lowry involved with Fiery Fest?" "It's true, Mark. But you're still involved, right, Quig? That steady hand at the steering wheel?" "I'm afraid not, Mark. Not since Billy McFarland gleefully spoiled the ending of the first season of Empire." "Jesus Christ," sighed Mark into the phone. "Then it's going to be a right old tits up." Mark had worked with Mick some years before, when Mark had gotten in touch about his Irish heritage. He stopped in Tiptown, and Mick Lowry's celebometer went la-la, and before long, Mick had the pop star cornered in Mahon's pub, trying to squeeze a bit of money out of the Blink-182 bass player and co-lead vocalist for the cause. He very politely listened for 7 hours to mad old Mick's drunken sort of pitches, and he left after he heard the following one. Basically, Mick wanted to open up a tattoo parlour that only did tattoos of the Ra, that was going to be called Ra Tattooey. So Mark, he told the rest of the Blinkers, "As far as I'm concerned, we gotta go." And the band, like you're meant to do during the act of it, if you don't want a baba, pulled out. The first day of the concert came, and everyone was abuzz with the news that it was cancelled and it was going to take ages to get everyone home. There was an air of schadenfreude from the Too Cool for School Hep Cap Brigade across the social media, which I really find hard to understand. To sneer at people who've paid over 10 grand to go to an uninhabited island with no infrastructure to not see Blink-182, with a bunch of entitled creeps and opportunists who immediately start turning on each other, is not funny. I'll tell you what is funny. Mr. Bean is funny. Yes, Mr. Bean. He doesn't laugh at people who've paid a lot of money to go through hell. No, he goes to the laundrette and all sorts of funny scenarios and skits present themselves. It's very funny. But I'll end this piece by just reading out a lovely letter that Billy wrote. And doing my little bit of commentary through it. It reads, "Today is definitely the toughest day of my life." Oh, thanks, Billy. What was the second toughest day of your life? That day that you met Jarud and thought, I wonder if I can trick this guy into going splits with me in a crazy, crazy adventure sort of holiday thing that'll ruin us both. Anyway, I'd love the opportunity to go through and tell my story of how we got here and how I see it now and where it's going. A bad storm came in at the morning ahead of the festival, taking down half of our tents. Well, I wonder if this mostly uninhabited island, because mostly uninhabited because it's in the eye of a sort of a hurricane place. I wonder if that's why people don't live there, but sure, we'll go on. Guests started to arrive, and the most basic function we take for granted in the US, we realised, well, we can't do this, he continued. What? Fucking easy, can't even run. We were on a rush job to fix everything. We were overwhelmed and just didn't have the foresight to solve all these problems. We were a little naive in thinking, for the first time, we could do this ourselves. Next year! Next year! God, that's like lads from the Hindenburg, right after the Hindenburg crashing, saying, the next flight's going to be much safer. We're going to figure all this out. Why'd you do it this time? Anyway, he said, the reality is we weren't experienced enough to keep up. No S. Leo Sherlock. McFarland confirmed that it'll be taking place in 2018. It won't be, though. There will be make-up dates, May 2018 in the US. Free for everybody who signed up the festival. Make-up dates? Who's going to go out there again? We will donate $150 per ticket to the Bahamian Red Cross. Okay. I hope that you refund everyone their money for us. This is dumb. You don't mess up and then say, we're sorry we're messed up. Next year we're going to try and do it better and we're also going to give money to charity. It doesn't matter. It's like missing somebody's birthday and then saying, next year I will remember your birthday and I'll also make a donation to charity. Doesn't matter. You're just telling me two unconnected, irrelevant things. This is... Charity is something you should do and not tell anyone about. It shouldn't be the second line in your press release after you've just overseen one of the biggest calamities in the history of kind of live event entertainment. You're giving money to charity. The one change we will make is we will not try to do it ourselves. We will make sure there is infrastructure in place to support us. Oh, well, that's very reassuring. So listen, everyone, whatever you go, okay, let's all try and help the lads out because Jazz is a good lad and Billy seems really, really dumb. So I will see you. I don't know about any of you, but I'm going to see me reflected in the sunglasses of another cool person at Firefest 2018, and I hope you'll join me. That's all for this week's podcast. Please stay tuned for a special comedy presentation, and please tell your friends about this podcast if you enjoy it. Let's get the word out there on quick, and the more of us that's in it, we can start having congregations and I can start baptizing people. And if you've got a sort of a possession type deal, I can also help out with that too. So until next week, well, actually next week I'm off on holiday. I'll be back the week after that. Until a fortnight, God bless you, God bless me, and please rise for the homily.
You've been listening to the Sunday Sermon Podcast by Giles Brody. You can follow me on Twitter at Giles Brody. Special thanks to Conor O'Toole, Emma Keaveney, and Jermond O'Brien.
Thank you. You are very welcome to this week's episode of the Oh My Faded Jeans podcast. This is a podcast I put out, so far it's been like every fortnight, made up of some stuff I do on the radio and in the future some other stuff, but right now it's just hard to get that kind of stuff together. I'm actually recording, if there's any discrepancy in quality in this, it's because I'm recording it on my phone, because I'm moving house and my MP3 recorder's packed away somewhere and I can't remember where I put it. So, I'm doing this on the phone. This, what you're about to hear is a conversation I had last night. I was trying to do some stuff on the radio to commemorate. It was 23 years since Kurt Cobain had passed away, and I was playing some Nirvana stuff on the radio. I was really getting into it, and I was, you know, espousing my views on the development of grunge and where grunge got started and all this kind of stuff. And then what I had planned on being an hour's tribute to Nirvana was rudely interrupted by somebody claiming to be a historian. You're going to hear it all coming up now. Totally got in the way of me doing my Nirvana tribute, but it seems to me that every time I get on the radio these days, there's someone getting on the line that doesn't just wants to mess it all up and me just get in my way, get all up in my grill, mess up my chance to just do a wee tribute to Kurt Cobain. But you're going to hear all of that coming up soon. If you like the podcast, tell your buddies, tell your family, tell your mother, tell your granddad, whoever you think will like this podcast. I want you to spread the word. And here you go. This is a very odd conversation I had on the radio last night. Okay, you're very welcome back to Storm the Orchard here on Dundalk FM. We are going to get into a load more Nirvana stuff now. I don't plan on saying very much. I just plan on playing this music and just enjoying it. All right, hang on. Wait, we do have a phone call in at the minute. Do you know what? I'm going to see what this person wants. I'm going to get them off the line and then we're going to carry on with this music, okay? So, caller, you're on the air at Dundalk FM.
Hey, Donnie, how are you doing?
I'm not doing too badly. It's Danny, actually.
Oh, hey, how are you doing?
Not too bad. Who am I speaking to?
This is Johnny Kindergan.
Johnny Kindergan?
Well, that's my professor name. You probably know me better as Ricky.
Ricky?
Yeah, Ricky.
I don't think I know a Ricky,
I'm
to be honest.
My brother of an associate of yours. He definitely brought me up.
Who is your brother?
He's only working hand-in-hand with Steve Bannon to make the world a better place.
Okay, I know who you're talking about. You're speaking about, okay, listeners, anyone who's heard the show before will be familiar that every time I try and get on the air and do something I want to do here, I'm getting continuously bombarded by this Nicky Fallon who keeps ringing me up trying to get me to do stuff I don't want to do.
Oh, he's a looper, yeah, yeah. Don't mind him. He's off in La La Land at the moment. I mean, he's doing well now, but sooner or later he's going to be back in the parents' house, having food handed to him, and him not giving them any money.
We heard all about this. And when you say La La Land, is he in L.A. or?
Yes, he's in L.A. at the moment. Yeah.
Well, as much strife as he's caused me, I'm happy he's doing well.
Yeah, yeah, he's doing great. He's over there at the moment. Himself and Bannon, they're trying to reboot Seinfeld.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And they've got some great people involved. Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn. And who is Vince Vaughn going to play?
He's going to be playing Jerry. Well, he's not going to be called Seinfeld in this. He's going to be called Patrick King.
Patrick King.
Yeah. And it's called King's Island.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's got, you know, there's going to be some really gas people. So there's him, there's Tim Allen. He's going to be in it too.
Tim Allen, is he? What role is he taking in that?
He was going to be playing, well, it's George Costanza, the character, but he's going to be playing a man called Matt Prince.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And,
Matt Prince.
Instead of Kramer and Elaine, he's going to get a tortoise.
A tortoise? Like an animal tortoise?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cheaper.
Yeah, no, that's true. Tortoises are cheaper than people. No one can argue with that.
Smart.
It is. Well, I suppose that remains to be seen.
Yeah. But you should see the diversity in the writing staff on this. There's some people from New Hampshire. There's some people from Upper New Hampshire. Some people from Lower New Hampshire.
Well,
there's 40 shades of pale in there.
It sounds like they've really combed the earth for that staff.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, I wanted to call up because I have a bone to pick with you about the origins of grunge.
Okay, it seems every time I try and do a program, a Fallon has a bone to pick with me.
Well, this is a pretty big bone.
I see.
I'm just getting a bit of takeaway at the moment. Sure. What's the biggest bone in the body? Tibia or fibia? You're not getting a tip, thanks. Sorry. My tip should have been, don't go expecting money for your job. I don't go around just putting my hand out asking people for money on top of doing my job. Anyway, that's how big a bone I have to pick with you.
A tibia?
Tibia size one, yeah.
Okay. You said you don't go around expecting people to give you money as well as doing your job. What is your job?
Oh, I'm a professor at the Dundalk Institute of Musical Enlightenment and General Gardening.
Dundalk Institute of?
Musical Enlightenment and General Gardening.
And General Gardening.
Everyone just calls it DMEG.
Okay, so you're a professor at DMEG.
Yeah.
And what have I done to upset you?
Well, basically, your facts are all wrong. Grunge didn't start in Seattle, Washington.
Really?
No, it didn't. It started in Dundalk in 1983.
Okay. Because any of the music history books that you read and anything about Nirvana, it's always the Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Washington, that whole area.
That was where they got inspired from. That was the inspiration for it. As you know, in the 80s, Dundalk did big business with the Boy Scouts of the world. And so there are always Boy Scouts coming through. And some of those Boy Scouts were in the Melvins. One of those Boy Scouts was Eddie Spaghetti from Super Suckers.
Okay.
Yeah, so they came by and they saw what I was doing, because I was involved in it back then. I was there at the beginning of grunge. It was I was kind of the father of grunge.
So not even the godfather of grunge, you were the father of grunge.
The father. What's a god? Why would you want to be the godfather?
You know what? I don't know. It's just something that people say in music magazines. I suppose I never really thought about it before.
Yeah. I was the father, but I was also the mother. I impregnated myself with the music and carried it to term.
Well, I'm having trouble getting my head around this. So, are you with the Boy Scouts at this point? Are you young, or are you a scoutmaster, or what way does that work?
No, I'm in my 30s.
Okay.
I'm running shows out of the boxing club.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the time, I was doing a bit of work in the city hall, or I was a pipe drawer. And at the time, the mayor, he was talking to some representatives, some big punk, who were concerned about their image and they wanted to kind of help their image out. And they experimented with, what if we made a group of people even less desirable to hang out with than punks?
Oh.
And they wanted to test it out in Dundalk.
Okay.
So I was privy to all those meetings. And when the mayor had neck leak, I stood in while he went to get fitted for his iron bib overseas.
He had neck leak?
Yeah, he was leaking out of his neck.
That's...
So it would occasionally just start coming out.
That sounds so unfortunate.
It's terrible. It was disgusting. And the smell was truly chilling.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was terrible. But anyway, someone had to step in as interim mayor and kind of keep this, you know, keep this big punk grant coming, because they're going to build something everyone can enjoy, like a multi-story car park or something. But they were going to use the money well.
Okay.
And so Anyway, we're looking for some kind of fresh thinkers. Matt Cameron from Soundgarden, he was a scoutmaster at the time, and he was paid a stipend to live in Dundalk. There was a 10-year-old drumming prodigy called Caroline Corr, who was local.
That's true.
And there was Joe Comfort on bass.
Joe Comfort?
Joe Comfort, yeah.
Who is Joe Comfort?
It's a bass player. He started off performing with Lionel Hampton's orchestra late 1920s. And he had a great partnership with Nat King Cole.
Okay, so he got involved somehow in this whole thing.
Yeah, he was quite expensive because obviously he was very old at the time. And this was a new kind of musical genre I was trying to create on the fly. I was a civil servant at the time, pipe drawer for the city.
Yeah.
And but I had to do this. I had to keep this because otherwise we'd lose the grant. We wouldn't be able to build the multi-story car parks.
This is just so far away from what we're led to believe is the sort of history of grunge. These sort of scruffy upstarts from, you know, not even really Seattle, but the smaller towns. And you're telling me it's all intertwined with Nat King Cole's bass player and Caroline Corr and the mayor getting neck leak and...
That's the real history of grunge. That's what nobody... If you write a comment on Pitchfork about that, it gets deleted. No matter how many times you spam Dave Grohl, he wants nothing to do with you. You go to the airport and, you know, you just cause a scene hoping that someone will take out their camera and you start screaming about how grunge was actually born in Dundalk and Caroline Corr and Nat King Cole's old bass player and your man from Soundgarden, how they were in the first real grunge band with me, and that band was called Warm Milk.
Warm Milk. And what did you do in this band, Ricky?
I was a singer.
You were the singer?
Yeah, Caroline was drumming, Joey Comfort on bass, slapping it. He was quite old. Old at the time.
Okay, so how did you explain it to him? Like, was the sound that something that just kind of happened by accident, or did you have to give these musicians some guidance? Or,
well, in Joey Comfort's case, he was quite hard of hearing at the time, so he just had to yell.
I see.
And his sight wasn't great, so he couldn't write him messages. So there's a lot of yelling. Matt Cameron, he kind of took the lead. I said... he started playing, you know, just some old skizzy skazzle stuff while he was tuning up. It didn't sound great. I said, yeah, keep doing that. And I asked Caroline Corr, was she proficient on the drums? And she said, no, I'm only 10. And I said, perfect. So she began clattering away. Matt Cameron started to play. Joey kind of, you know, he just doing, you know, the classics. But Nat King Cole was a merry old soul. Often sing to himself, and I came in with the lyrics, and I think if you heard the lyrics, it's kind of indisputable.
What kind of things were you writing about, Ricky? Like, because what we were led to believe about sort of the way grunge came up was that it was a lot of angst, a lot of sort of people disillusionment, sort of, and the disillusionment of young people in their late teens, early 20s, and their, you know, in the face of things like the Gulf War and all this kind of stuff, just like a general malaise and, you know, people wondering if it was even worth being alive sometimes. How did your lyrics fit into all of that?
Well, it's very much, we're all kind of going to the same trough. We're eating the same kind of creative oats. Because that was very much reflected in my lyrics, those big issues, you know.
Even though you were a civil servant in his 30s?
Yeah, married. House, two kids, parents live down the road, her parents live two roads over, my best friend lives next door, and he's married to my other best friend.
Oh, really?
So I was, my Peter and Caroline.
And which one did you know first, if you don't mind me asking?
I knew Peter first.
Okay.
Yeah, then Caroline. But I've been with... My wife, Peggy Sue, since we first met when we were five. And
no, you haven't been a couple since you were five.
Yes, yeah. She hasn't gotten rid of me yet.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I really, you know, my lyrics were really kind of infused with that kind of that primal existential. What the hell is going on? You know, because you know sometimes you know at the golf club social, like I might just blow it on a hole. You know, I'd be like 300 par the whole way, and then I'd suddenly be like, you know, at the putter and it's on the green and six, and then it gets embarrassing, and they say, oh, well, we'll round it down to seven. You go, no, Niall, just put down nine. So I really, that's really what grunge is about, that feeling.
So you were no stranger to hard times.
No, I wasn't.
So, well, look, it does sound like you were, you know, you, even though you were in your 30s and you were a fully employed man, it still sounds like you were, you know, you were living a confused existence.
Yeah, because sometimes on a Saturday I wouldn't know if I wanted to go to the rugby or go just watch the football. My kids are really into quizzes, and I am too. I really like them, so some weekends when they have a quiz competition on somewhere, we'll drive in the car. We did back then, and we were, you know, I'd be quizzing them, and they'd be quizzing me, and we'd be keeping each other sharp, and, you know, it was fun. And then afterwards, I tell them, I love you no matter what happens. We have a sing-song to the Jungle Book. So
that all sounds very nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, but there's angst there in the tracks. I'd imagine.
You invented this. Well, you claim to have invented this genre. So, I mean, the angst must have come from somewhere. It doesn't, you know, it's got to pop up.
Yeah, because like when we're doing these gigs, what's it called? The boxing club. They were after, there'd be like a fight going on around you. And so you'd have to jump around to avoid the boxers.
Well, hang on. You see, you were doing the gigs in the ring during the matches.
Yeah. And people didn't want us there.
Well, they were probably confused.
As soon as you brought Joe Comfort up and sat him in that stool, they knew something was up. And then Andrea Corr, she'd go up with just like, or not Andrea, sorry, Caroline. Andrea was a roadie, though. She would help Caroline set up her drums and then get the hell out of there.
So 10-year-old Caroline Corr is in this dangerous boxing club with people mad at her because she's interrupting the boxing match.
Yeah. But don't worry, Matt Cameron from Soundgarden, he sort of protected her by sort of hiding behind her. Because the first wave is never going to be as bad as the second. So he was taking that for her. That's what he told me.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but we rocked. We rocked that place out. And all the scouts came in. We blew their minds. They knew about, you know, like you ask any of those guys, Eddie Spaghetti from Super Suckers, the Melvins, any of those guys. That was where they first, Warm Milk was the first grunge. And our song was called Grunge. So that's where it all came from.
So not only did you invent the sound, but the name comes from you guys too.
Yes, of course. Yeah, you've got to name it something. I mean, you know, you can't just call it headache music. No, you got to give it a name that people will go, oh, what does that mean?
So yeah, maybe Whinge would have been even better.
Whinge, well, I thought, for a while I thought Sponge. Because sponges, like everyone has them, they've got good market recognition. And emotionally, a sponge is something you wash yourself with.
Emotionally?
In a shower or a bath.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, so
this is blowing my mind. So I just, what happened to the band? I mean, like, obviously all these other musicians heard you and were influenced by you. So your records must have been, were they passed around in sort of tape trading circles? How did that work?
Well, we only played that one gig that one time.
In the boxing club?
That one song, but it shaped a whole generation.
And how do you know that?
Because of the lyrics. It's just grunge. If you heard it, you go, oh, of course.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have the lyrics? Could you do like an impromptu performance of that song?
Oh, I couldn't. Oh, you're putting me on the spot now.
I'm sorry, but you can't pique people's interest like this and then...
Oh, I couldn't. I just couldn't, Andy. I couldn't. Unless you gave me some sort of accompaniment yourself musically, you know, with your mouth or with your hands or something.
Okay, well, what do you want me to do?
Okay, could you kind of do it like this?
Okay, I can do that.
Okay.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah. Yeah. Good, yeah.
Yeah. Are you going to come in, or...?
Bit faster.
All right.
Yeah. Getting jiggy with it. 1983. Here we go. My stage name was just time. My name is Johnny. I'm the inventor of grunge. It's a new musical genre. Won't you take the plunge? It's fun on your ears and it'll get you jiving. Peace on earth is for what I'm striving. It's a real neat piece and I ain't gonna lie. Grunge is sweet. It's sweeter than pie. I wear flannel and my jeans are torn, but I've loved my mama since the day I was born. I don't mess with Johnny Law except for library fines, and I just get forgetful from reading Gertrude Stein. Let's have a hold down. I'm grungy. Thank you, Boxing Club. Leave her alone. She's only 10. Stop hitting her. You're on your own, Caroline.
I feel like some of this was written during the performance.
Yes, well, parts of it were later incorporated because we heard a lot of it back. There was a recording of that, but it was only played in court.
Okay, well, who took you to court?
The boxing club.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they booked you, surely?
No, they hadn't. No, we just showed up and we rushed the stage and we did that song.
So you weren't even actually booked to perform?
It was, yeah, that's why it's such a legendary performance. The night grunge was born.
Oh, this gets odder every time I hear a new detail.
Well, that's this is it. This is, you know, history. You can't, you know, you mightn't like the JFK assassination, but it happened.
That's, yeah. Well, I mean, I probably wouldn't have jumped to that comparison, but that's true.
Well, what was bigger in the world
than grunge?
No. Well, yeah.
Than JFK.
I guess, yeah. Grunge was probably bigger than JFK.
Sorry, grunge, McDonald's, JFK.
Huh?
That's McDonald's is probably in the middle between grunge and JFK.
Hang on, let's work this out. So, okay, no. Are you talking about JFK when he was alive or JFK while he was being shot? Because that's probably number one.
Yeah, okay, that's true.
Okay. That's the most famous gun. Number two, okay, I guess McDonald's, I'll concede that point. I saw that film The Founder where Bruce Wayne, he got his millions by ripping off these burger boys.
I haven't seen it, I've heard of it though.
Yeah, that's how, it's kind of like a prequel, sequel to Batman. It shows how he got all his money.
Oh, and then he goes and builds the Batcave and all that.
Yeah, yeah, but you get to see him back when he's just, you know, a sleazy huckster.
Oh, right. So that's definitely a new spin on the Batman ethos, legend.
Yeah, I think it's bold. I'd love to see, like, you know, something about, like, Bruce Wayne when he was a Montessori.
Yeah.
Sow the seeds there. He could be a Montessori with Poison Ivy. He could be in there with the Joker. He could be in there with the Riddler. He could be in there with Bane.
As babies.
Yeah.
Oh, right, I get you. That would be great, actually. I think that's an idea worth pursuing.
Well, look, I'll pass it on to my brother. Or, you've probably more contact with him than I do at this stage.
Not through choice, Ricky, I have to admit.
Yeah, how was Washington? I heard you got deported.
I got deported. He has me roped into just shooting a sizzle reel for a Raging Bull style biopic on Joe Dolan. He wants me to play Joe's brother, Toe Dolan.
Oh, you're going to play Toe?
Yeah. Well, in the sizzle reel, at least.
Oh, my God. That's a meaty part. Because we all heard about what happened. That's all based on... Because both those guys, Joe and Toe, are both dead now.
Yeah.
So there's no way of contradicting...
Yeah, well, this was very much Nicky's take on it, that he, because he's the only person who's still around out of all those people, that he's got some sort of control over what's true and what isn't.
Yeah, yeah. So he gets the right. He history's written by the winners, huh?
That's very true. We're kind of running out of time a little bit, Ricky. Very quickly, did you meet Kurt Cobain himself during all of this?
Oh yeah, yeah. I met Kurt Cobain. Yeah.
How did that go?
He and I were in the outside the Viper Room, and we were there with this lad, Stream or something like that. And they knew I was diabetic, so they asked me for a needle because I think he was too. And wouldn't you know it, he took a bad turn, and we all had to go home early.
Oh, isn't it always the way?
Always the way.
Okay, Ricky, we're past the hour. I'm enjoying this conversation, but we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Nice one. Here, I'll talk to you later on.
No problem. Thanks for filling us in on the history of grunge. We're all a little bit more knowledgeable now.
Free. And also, if you want to go to the online school, Dundalk Institute of Musical Enlightenment and General Gardening, just look up dimegg.ie.
Dimegg. Thanks very much, Ricky.
All right. Good luck.
Okay, so that's the end of it.
So that was a conversation I had last night on the radio with historian Ricky Fallon. Big thanks to Giles Brody. You can follow Giles Brody on Twitter at Giles Brody, or you can check out his weekly podcast, the Sunday Sermon Podcast. If you go to sundaysermonpodcast.com, you're going to find even more comedy goodness from Mr. Giles Brody. You can follow me at DannyOHQ on Twitter. Thanks very much for downloading the podcast. Like I say, share and share alike if you like it. You know, just get a few more people interested. There's no point in being cool about it. You know, just like I want anyone who might think that this is entertaining to hear it. So, you know, not being cool anymore. Just download it, share it. God bless you if you're doing any of those things. Rate it on iTunes, write a review if you're feeling energetic, you know. As a little podcast extra, I'm just going to throw up a clip here. This is some audio of me messing around on my laptop recording an Elliott Smith song. At some point in, I want to say, it was probably late 2015 when I recorded this, just on the internal mic on my computer. I was going through a bit of an Elliott Smith phase, as happens. I'm kind of going through one at the minute. And this is me doing, I believe it's No Name number 3. I might have mislabeled it. I can never keep track of all these no names that he did, but this is probably No Name number 3. So, thanks for downloading the podcast, and hopefully I'll have some... have some stuff for you next week. Any fans of my old podcast, the Spot Meat podcast, my goal is to coax my old podcasting partner Niall McCann into doing an interview with me at some point, and putting it out as an episode of this, just to catch up, do a little podcast catch up. I'm moving house at the minute. I'd like to get it done this week. Niall, if you're listening, you know, let me know what you think about that. Maybe this next, even next week. If it was next week sometime, we'd get, look, I'll have this conversation with him. But anyway, here is me singing Elliott Smith, and cheerio. Best of luck. See you all again soon. You're a witness.
is gone, home to oblivion, home to oblivion, home to oblivion, home to oblivion. To oblivion, home to oblivion.